Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine with you on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 8th. Thanks for your support during our just concluded Spring Pledge Drive. We reached the $275,000 goal at about 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon. And as promised, we ended the pledge drive right then and there. So instead of asking for your contributions for part of this hour, we will spend the entire time talking about the impending threats to plant and animal life on land and at sea. Good thing we have the full hour, as we have a lot of territory to cover. Our guest has covered all of this territory in her work as a nature documentary maker and an environmental journalist. She has a brand new book out, just published yesterday, called The Fragile Edge. It's about the fragility of our oceans and underwater ecosystems. And as this book is hitting the bookshelf, she also has an article in the latest issue of Mother Jones Magazine about the vanishing species, primarily on land, the extinction of plants and animals and birds. And this article wonders, who will survive if scientists are right and by the end of the century, half of all species are gone? We'll talk about the causes and cures and the threats to our biosystems, and we will ask our guest and welcome your questions. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890. 263-1890. Our guest is Julia Witte. She is the author of The Fragile Edge, Diving and Other Adventures in the South Pacific, which was just published yesterday by Houghton Mifflin. She is writer and author of the cover story in the May-June issue of Mother Jones Magazine called Gone, and she has written and produced more than 70 documentaries for PBS, National Geographic, and the Discovery Channel, among others. She joins us from Northern California. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Well, let's start with water first and the message of your book, The Fragile Edge. What is it?
Well, I'm referring specifically to the coral reefs of the world, and the book takes place mostly in the South Pacific, but the stories and the lessons are applicable to coral reefs around the world. And I say that reefs really are the fragile edge between the land and the sea, because they're part of the ocean world, but they're so deeply affected by everything that we do on the land. So our impact is enormous offshore on this very fragile edge, which basically is a nursery ground seeding the life of the ocean, similar to the way rainforests are nursery grounds seeding biodiversity on the land.
Well, first of all, exactly what is a coral reef?
A coral reef is actually a big architectural structure that's built by tiny little animals about the size of ants. But working together, they, over the centuries and eons, they create enormous sort of rock structures that provide living space, sort of condominiums, for every other form of life imaginable. So, you know, just hundreds and thousands of species of fish and many invertebrates, and many of them in the tropical ocean, of course, being incredibly beautiful, incredibly colorful, and having the most fascinating and intricate lifestyles. And I talk about this quite a lot in my book, The Fragile Edge.
Yeah. I went scuba diving once in my life. It was just a resort course thing in Cozumel, Mexico. And I did some snorkeling in the Florida Keys. And it is absolutely stunning, the beauty of these coral reefs and all the aquatic life. But these two areas, I understand, are, you know, I mean, that's it's they continue to have the coral reefs, but they are endangered. They are vanishing.
Very much so, yes. Right now, about 25% of the reefs worldwide are seriously impacted by human activities, and 50% are in threatened within the coming decades, and possibly more and possibly faster. Because along with all the human assaults that come from just us living on these coastlines, so the problems of development, of runoff, of fertilizers from, you know, agriculture coming out into the sea. And coral reefs, oddly, need a very nutrient-poor environment. They survive with very little nutrients in the water. And if you add nutrients in the form of fertilizers, you completely change the ecology of the reef. In fact, you kill off the corals, and you end up with something that looks like an undersea lettuce garden. Doesn't support nearly as much life as a living reef. But adding to these kinds of problems on the land, we now have the really big really heavy hitter that's impacting reefs around the world, and that's global warming.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, corals are actually hybrid creatures, and they're little partnerships between plants and animals. They're not just a plant alone. And the plant part of the coral has a little, the animal part has a little plant partners. And when the temperature in the sea rises beyond a very small threshold of just a few degrees, the corals become stressed and they expel their little plant partners. Now, their little plant partners are what actually make the corals their beautiful colors. And when they expel them, the corals are said to bleach, and they just look like white bone. They lose all their beautiful colors. They also can't survive very long. The plant partners perform some very important functions in the relationship, helping them to feed. And so without them, if that warming goes on for more than a few days, there's a good chance that the corals will become stressed enough that they'll die. And we have been seeing mass dying in the past 10 and 15 years across entire ocean basins from global warming as the reefs bleach.
Yeah, boy, so there's global warming that's contributing to the demise of the coral reefs. There's the stuff we do on land, like the development and the runoff that's hurting them. Are we loving them to death? I understand that just touching the coral reef will kill it, human contact.
Yeah, they're very fragile, and it's important part, you know, where there's tourism on reefs to really teach people and educate them. They can't clamber around on the coral heads, not to land on them, not to kick them with their fins. And, of course, it's hard because a lot of people who might come to that world are novice divers, and they're not in very good control of their bodies underwater, so they tend to bump into things. So it is important in a way that we maybe create zones, you know, where you allow tourists into so they can experience this beautiful world, but to allow some areas to be set aside where they don't have to suffer our presence, you know, which, although it's well-meaning, can be kind of harmful.
Yeah. And so why, again, are, though, the coral reefs so important? And why should we be concerned that they're dying off?
Well, like, they are, in essence, the rainforests of the sea. And what that means is they are wellsprings of biodiversity. And what that means is they are really the genetic legacy of the ocean, as rainforests are the genetic legacy of the land. So what you have there is you basically have the robust immune system of either the land or the sea. You have enormous amounts of biodiversity, enormous amounts of genetic diversity on a coral reef, which means if you have problems, if you're losing species, this is where the new species will be born from. This is your bank account, basically. And when you begin to lose enormous numbers from your bank account, well, we all know what happens when we lose a lot of money from our bank account. It's a bad thing. So that is a huge part of the problem with coral reefs.
Yeah, so what is it that we can do about the disappearing coral reefs?
Well, you know, this goes back to something that I write and talk about on so many fronts these days. And, I mean, yes, there's a lot that governments need to do, and internationally we need to do to regulate our own behaviors. But I continually come back to, you know, our personal decisions that we make in our lives to limit the size of our own footprint on this planet. And, you know, the less we use and consume and take up space and waste and abuse, the better it is for all the life of the planet, not just coral reefs.
We're talking with Julia Witte. She is the author of The Fragile Edge, Diving and Other Adventures in the South Pacific, in which she talks much about the endangered coral reefs. And we will also talk with her about the cover story that she wrote for Mother Jones magazine out this month, entitled Gone, that half, perhaps, of all species will be gone by the end of the century. And we'll welcome your questions for her about threats to plant and animal life on land and sea, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, 20 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, May the 8th. At issue with Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6, a special live broadcast From the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee, the annual Kennan Forum. From the Institute of World Affairs, Ben will be moderating a discussion between two special guests talking about Israeli-Palestinian relations. He'll be taking questions from a live studio audience and from callers like you. So I hope you join in this special two-hour live broadcast at issue between 4 and 6 this afternoon. We're talking about biodiversity, our fragile oceans, threats to plant and animal life on land and at sea with Julia Witte. She is an environmental journalist, a documentary maker, author of the new book, The Fragile Edge, Diving and Other Adventures in the South Pacific, which was just published yesterday. And she's also the writer of the cover story in the May-June issue of Mother Jones magazine called Gone. It's actually, by the end of the century, half of all species will be gone. Who will survive? And we'll talk with her some about that as well. 1-800-642-1234 is the number you can call if you have a question for her in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. So is that right, Julia Witte, that scientists are predicting that half of all species will be gone by the end of the century?
On our present course, yes. Mm. And scientists have recognized that in the past on Earth, there have been at least five great extinctions or mass extinction events. And we're now in the middle of what is considered the sixth great extinction. Some of them from the past were so bad that they wiped out nearly all life on Earth, perhaps 95% or more of all life forms on Earth. That jeopardizes life itself on Earth when you get numbers that low. And the sixth great extinction, which is currently underway and is really completely at our hands, is happening faster and in a more deadly fashion than any of the natural mass extinctions of the past. So it is extremely alarming, and some of our most eminent scientists believe that on our present course we're going to lose 50% of all species of plants and animals in 93 years by the year 2100.
That's startling. Why is this, why do you say it's completely at our hands?
Well, the sixth great extinction began when we actually left Africa somewhere around 50,000 years ago with our Ice Age technology of, you know, spears and arrows and so forth. And we moved out into the great retreat of the Ice Age, you know, landscapes, and we began to kill off the unique megafauna of those times. So the woolly mammoths and the saber-toothed tigers and those really giant things that roamed most of the Earth at that time and no longer do, most scientists now believe really were most likely killed off at our hands with our technology. And as bad as that was, it's nothing compared to what we're doing today as we continue to not only destroy the lands and the waters that most of the biodiversity of the Earth needs to live in, but as we change the climate itself.
Yeah. Is it mainly the climate change issue that's contributing to these extinctions, or are there other things?
There's many other things. And, you know, there's everything from habitat loss is probably the biggest thing. So basically what we found with species is that they need, you know, wilderness is what supports wildlife, whether it's plants or animals. And wilderness needs friendly neighbors. So we have a national park these days, but what's all around it? Too often, completely developed lands that are totally unsuitable to allowing new creatures and plants to come and go to sort of migrate through the environment. And if you don't have that, then even large protected lands like Yellowstone National Park will lose biodiversity over time, biodiversity being the sum of an area's genes, species, and ecosystem types. Mm-hmm. So if you don't have access to a much bigger and broader landscape, then you do lose biodiversity over time.
Reading your article, I didn't realize the importance of the threat posed by fences. That is one of the, it breaks up the habitat, stops the roaming of some of these animals, and can contribute to their extinction?
Absolutely. All of the barriers that we put up in wilderness or between even semi-wilderness areas or areas that might enable the movement of animals between protected areas, many species will not cross our barriers, including roads. So everything from beetles to bears won't cross roads, either because they're fearful of coming out into an openness like that, because it doesn't exist in nature, or they die trying. So there, you know, maybe we'll get around to talking about some of the solutions that we see, but one of them is to find ways to mitigate the impact of these barriers, and there are ways to do that. We scientifically know how to do it. It's not that big a deal. It's not that expensive. It's been pioneered in other areas, and it works very well. So there are solutions to this.
So what solutions are there to the barriers?
Well, for instance, I mean, I talk at the end of the article about a very large continent-wide approach that scientists are sort of getting on board with now. It's spearheaded by a group called the Wildlands Project, and it talks about rewilding the world, and rewilding particularly North America. And the way we would do that is by scientifically understanding exactly of what lands of the important protected areas that are available, what lands could we open up a little bit more than they currently are to facilitate the movement of wildlife back and forth between those protected lands. And what they find is that we know, for instance, in Banff National Park in Canada, that they have facilitated some very nice, they're broad and vegetated highway overpasses. So they're very inviting to wildlife. Wildlife says, well, I could go down onto that tarmac road where there's nothing to eat. Or, look, there's this big ramp that's spanning the road and grass is growing on it and flowers are growing on it. I think I'll go that way. And so there's simple ways to actually funnel wildlife over dangerous areas and minimize the impact of car-wildlife collisions, which is a huge impact on some of the big predators, which are very important to biodiversity. Things like that, sometimes it's tunnel systems going under roads. Sometimes it's paying, you know, ranchers to take down some fences and or to make sure that the riparian areas along their stream beds, which are like highways for wildlife, are left vegetated so their cattle don't graze those areas. They allow wildlife to move up those important natural highways as they travel between ecosystems.
Yeah. I don't know if it was your article or something else I read that said another thing you might want to do is not build a fence like a fence separating the United States and Mexico.
Yeah, that was in the article. That's sort of where I ended up, because the Wildlands Project, which I mentioned, right now one of their big focuses on one of the most endangered linkages between ecosystems happens right at the U.S.-Mexico border around Arizona. This is the area we're not talking about putting in a 700-mile border fence to keep illegal immigrants out. I went down there to look into this story, and I found, when I looked at it, the fence is not going to keep illegal immigrants out because, you know, people are seriously motivated, and all it's going to do, frankly, is weed out so that, well, we get the really strong and the really tough and the really athletic illegal immigrants coming over. But it is going to keep out nature's immigrants, and it's a hugely important linkage area for some of the most endangered wildlife in North America, including bison, Sonoran pronghorns, and jaguars, which are just starting to return back over the border from Mexico for the first time in many decades. If we erect that fence, that'll put an end to that.
Yeah. Got an email from Doug in Poplar who says, what evidence is there that life on Earth has ever been static? Haven't life forms gone through numerous extinctions? The human species has become overabundant and the Earth is altering to adjust.
Well, obviously, nothing is static in nature, and that's what we want to make sure of. I mean, by having a lot of biodiversity, we make sure that nature can flex and shift and change course and adjust. If we remove biodiversity, if we remove the stuff of life itself, we leave nature very few opportunities or options to adjust. So basically, we're destroying the immune system of nature. We're saying we're going to take away your immune system or we're going to introduce a lot of diseases, but we expect you to get used to it. Well, it isn't going to happen. The other thing is we have had mass extinctions, as I said, in the past. We know of at least five. They have been huge. They've been a lot more slow-acting. There has been somewhat more time for nature to adjust than we are giving it now. And the studies done by scientists show that the downside of a mass extinction, and one reason you might really like to avoid it if you're the one causing it, is because it takes a minimum of 10 million years to recover biodiversity. And you don't ever get back your lost species, but to get to a level of richness on Earth, a minimum of 10 million years.
We're talking with Julia Witte. She is the author of the brand new book, The Fragile Edge, which is about the endangered and disappearing coral reefs and the underwater ecosystems. And she's also the author of an article that's in the current issue of Mother Jones. By the end of the century, half of all species will be gone. So we're talking about impending threats to plant and animal life on land and at sea, and what we can do about those threats. We welcome your questions for her. We have some open lines, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. We did have a caller who I guess was too shy to actually ask this on the air, but I'll ask it for her, wants to know, what is it we can do to save the polar bears from the melting ice caps? You do talk about this in your article, and I want to talk about that, but I also want to talk about how you say that that's a well-known problem. There are lots of others that we don't hear as much about.
Right. Mm-hmm. So polar bears are an important, you know, visible impact of what's happening on with the loss of species, and in their case due to a couple of things: global climate change and to some extent a lot of pollution in the oceans. Okay, they're high-end predators. They bioaccumulate mm-hmm. all the toxins and pollutions that we're putting out into the environment, and they have things like PCB levels and things of some of our industrial chemicals that are actually affecting their fertility and their ability to reproduce. But most of all now, we're concerned about the fact that the Arctic ice pack is melting more so every year, and that without that sea ice, they cannot maintain the lifestyle that they know. And in fact, scientists have begun to find polar bears sort of far out at sea drowning, and it's mm-hmm. because there's no ice for them to haul up onto and mm-hmm. rest in between their hunting expeditions. So, you know, the truth of the matter is, we may be too late for polar bears, because right now the thermal inertia that's in the atmosphere and in the ocean, there's no way we're going to slow down in 500 years the melting of the Arctic. So that, I don't really know.
Yeah, it's really sad. I mean, it's not as though we can put more ice caps up there for the bears to rest on. I mean, even if we cut greenhouse gas emissions and tried to do as much as possible right now, it may be too late.
For polar bears, it might be, at least for some populations of polar bears. And we would hope that others might still find a way to make a living in perhaps some still icy environments and or even, mm-hmm. you know, go back to maybe more of a land-based lifestyle, which is possible. Bears are very creative in that regard. So perhaps something like that could happen. There may be some evidence of some of that going on. But frankly, you know, even if we can't help those polar bears, we still need to slow down global warming for everything else on Earth, including ourselves.
Yeah. And when we talk about or hear about extinction, we might think of the polar bear. You say that they are only small pieces of the extinction puzzle. What do you mean?
Well, you know, we have a catalog of how many species on Earth are endangered. It's put together by the World Conservation Union, and it's the work of 10,000 scientists in nations across the world, and they have been assessing the status of species. And of the 40,000 species that have been assessed, and in some cases this is like virtually all mammals and virtually all birds, we're finding that 1 in 4 species of mammals, 1 in 8 species of birds, 1 in 3 of amphibians, and 1 in 3 of all the conifers are in danger of extinction. And there's even higher numbers further down the line in some of crustaceans and various insects and things like that. So it's a very alarming list. It's been kept for some decades now, and no matter the efforts we've made up until now to slow down or even stop the decline of species, our efforts have not succeeded until now. This red list, which is put together about every 4 years, continues to grow at a kind of a metastatic rate. It's exponentially growing in a most alarming fashion, and this is why scientists, biologists, a poll that was fairly recently done among biologists found that they consider the sixth great extinction and the loss of biodiversity a greater threat to the future of life on Earth than global warming.
Hmm. Roger in Dodgeville is with us. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question. You talked about a few solutions, but I know habitat loss through development, through pollution, through many things is the main problem here. And my question is, the majority of the people are urban or suburban, and they're creating the majority of the problem. Now, fences on ranches or fences along the border aren't what the majority of the people can do. So what are solutions the majority of the people can do? And one of my experiences is, and I'll use Al Gore as an example, the liberal elite are happy to talk about global warming and other things, but when it really comes down to them carpooling or them installing geothermal or them reducing their carbon dioxide, they're not willing to do it. They're just happy to talk about it.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. We all have to put our money where our mouth is on this, and that's what I've been talking about for some years now, is we really all have to make personal lifestyle choices that reflect the understanding that the planet has a finite energy budget. And when we overspend it, just as with our own budgets, we're going to have problems. And that's basically what we're doing. So I do ask people on all levels to begin to basically think about their impact on the Earth. And there's a lot of stuff out there to help us think about that. There's a lot of books. There's a lot of stuff on the Internet to help us understand what choices we make. You know, and it can be simple things like, do you really want to pay to buy those cherries that are coming up from Chile in the mid of winter and all the carbon emissions that it takes to get, or do you want to wait till summer and buy the local guys cherries or whatever? You know what I'm saying? There are many decisions we can make on many levels that will affect, you know, things to come. And it's important that every one of us begin to sort of calculate that in our own lifestyle choices.
Yeah, so buying locally will save animals from extinction?
It's going to help. You know, the more we lessen our impact on the Earth, the better it is. Now, the rewilding plan that I talked about, which is what many scientists believe is the only hope right now for actually slowing down and perhaps eventually even arresting the sixth great extinction, that is a 100-year plan that they're talking about for sort of reopening and rewilding some of these larger, particularly mountainous spine areas of North America so that wildlife can continue to move around and replenish itself. And, you know, we can help with that. There's ways you can just support the local organizations. Mm-hmm. A lot of it just comes from smaller kind of regional environmental groups that are working to actually put in a highway overpass so animals don't get, you know, important things like bears aren't killed on the roads and so on. And, you know, your support of that, your lifestyle choices, and obviously how you vote. Do you vote for candidates who understand the importance of this kind of science in the future of life on Earth? That's a very important thing for us to begin to do.
We're talking with Julia Witte. She is the author of the new book, The Fragile Edge, which talks about the endangered and disappearing coral reefs, the underwater, the threats to our oceans. She's also the author of an article on extinction and how by the end of the century, half of all species will be gone, according to scientists, if we stay on the present course. That's in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine. We're talking about threats to plant and animal life on land and at sea. And we welcome your questions for her. Are you concerned about biodiversity. Do you agree with some scientists who say that the loss of biodiversity is worse than global warming? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. And maybe what are you doing to try to help the situation, if anything? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen will be talking current issues and politics with Sidney Blumenthal coming up after 9. And then after 10, she'll talk about an evolutionary biologist. She'll talk with an evolutionary biologist about Darwinism and how we can apply it to better understand ourselves and the world. That's coming up, Kathleen Dunn, between 9 and 11. We're talking about all things environmental with Julia Witte. She's an environmental journalist, a nature documentary maker. She has produced and written more than 70 documentaries for PBS, National Geographic, the Discovery Channel, among others. She is the author of the new book, The Fragile Edge: Diving and Other Adventures in the South Pacific. And she is the author of the cover story in the May-June issue of Mother Jones magazine entitled Gone, about how so many species on this earth are going extinct and how half of them may be gone by the end of the century. And we do now have full lines with callers who want to get in on the conversation. So let me go to Derek in Madison. Hi, Derek. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I think this is very similar to some of the global warming discussion that's happened over the last 5 and 10 years. At first, there were a lot of doubters. And as awareness increases and understanding increases, people realize that this is not just climate change. It's a man-made phenomenon. And I wonder what evidence there is to point to this mass extinction compared to others in history to show how much of this is human contribution and how much of this is perhaps a natural cycle.
Well, in the article, I described the fact that, you know, there is a normal so-called background extinction rate, and that most scientists now agree that the extinction rate currently underway is 1,000 to 10,000 times higher than a normal background extinction rate. And it's very obvious when you examine any of these 40,000 species that have already been examined by the Red List that they are all impacted by human activities, the loss of their natural homes, pollution, changes in global climate, things like that. Within science, there's absolutely no doubt that all of this is human-caused. And in fact, there's so much alarm among biologists that there have been calls in the last couple of years to create a large international panel akin to the IPCC. You may have heard of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that's been issuing the reports this year on the changes in global climate and advising governments on what to do. There's calls to do a similar thing for mass extinction now in order to advise governments how to tackle this problem.
We had an email, interesting, from Michael in Phoenix, Arizona, and he wonders, why do I suspect that invasive species are the most likely to survive? Even as Hawaii has the most endangered species of any state, it is home to thriving populations of mongoose, wild European pigs, and most recently the collie frog from Puerto Rico. Invasive species are taking over the natural species or the native species?
Pretty much. And what happens is when you disrupt wilderness, you sort of create a wound in the natural order of wilderness. And, you know, pathogens and infectious type agents come into the wound just as when you cut your own skin. And this is what happens is you get invasive exotics from around the world coming in. So those edges of wilderness they create something in biology known as the edge effect. And you get, in essence, you know, you may have even seen this on the edge of a natural prairie or a natural woodland, that you'll have this really thicket of weed growth. And it acts almost like a scar on wilderness. It lets very little in or out through it because it's so thick. These are, in fact, terrible problems for native species anytime you introduce you know, and even you know this as agricultural pests, non-native pests can come in and just annihilate a natural ecosystem or an established ecosystem. So these are very real problems, and they are one of the major contributors to the loss of biodiversity.
Now, help us understand, Julia Witte, why we hear news from time to time about brand new species of plants or animals just being discovered for the very first time when we're in the midst of losing all these species.
Well, it's one of the great ironies of science right now that scientists who are concerned about the sixth great extinction realize that in order to even begin to protect what's left, we first of all need to know what is left. And the truth is, we don't know very much about the life on Earth. We've currently cataloged somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 million species of everything. But some scientists think there could be many, many, many more species than that, perhaps 100 times that many. We don't know yet. But there's a big push underway, both in topside land environments and in watery underwater environments, to try to catalog what is there. And so you're getting, you know, every week pretty much right now, we are getting announcements of new species of everything, and it's part of this global initiative to try and really catalog all life on Earth.
So in cataloging all of the species, new ones are being discovered, even though some are being lost.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, many of them are being discovered sort of at the marginal edge of their existence.
Yeah.
And some are being discovered because they're so small, and an awful lot. We've been getting about 3 new species of fish a week because of a huge push called the Census of Marine Life. And, of course, that's mostly going into environments that we've barely looked at until now.
Craig in Onalaska is with us next. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm just wondering how optimistic or pessimistic the guest is. It seems to me that with the inertia that governments have and people have and corporations, a good example of that is, you know, since the oil embargo of the 70s, not much has been done to really get us into alternative fuels for vehicles. So what's your feeling? Do you think that there's much of a realistic chance that we're going to be able to turn things around, or are we just losing things?
Well, I think that's an excellent question, Craig. And, you know, I think we can do it. And I wrote about this in a previous article with Mother Jones. The truth of the matter is once we kind of reach that critical mass, and I think we're approaching it on some of these issues, I think the global warming is actually really beginning to approach critical mass where the world and most citizens and most governments are really finally saying, hey, this is a problem. When we reach that, you know, the history of humankind shows that we are capable of enormous change on a dime. We can really change when we want to. I mean, when we went to war in 1941, we retooled the entire U.S. economy in 1 year. It can be done. We can do these things. In fact, our history is full of our ability to adapt very, very quickly. So I know it's easy to feel hopeless in the face of this stuff, but I have to say we need to fight that lethargy that kind of comes into us and continue the fight, because every little step forward is moving us closer to the critical mass, at which point we will tip over and really begin to make the changes that need to be made.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Craig, for the call. Mark in Richland Center is with us now. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good morning. I want to thank you for this. I want to go back to what an earlier caller mentioned about the problem residing in urban centers. And Ms. Witte's response was having to do with the food system. One of the bright lights on this scene is the urban food movement, led right here in Milwaukee by Will Allen and a group called Growing Power. If you check out growingpower.org, he's an urban farming center that's doing food production and food distribution right in the cities. Collaboration between Growing Power and other groups out of Columbia University has a group. If you check out verticalfarm.org, the research done by them shows that a 50-story building that is a greenhouse with hydroponic plant production can feed 50,000 people. So the business of our food system now having a huge dependency on transportation, it can be addressed relatively fast as soon as we start to build in the city food production facilities. We have to rethink the idea of agriculture, because instead of spreading out over many acres, we have to go up. But in the urban landscape, as well as any other landscape, the sun shines no matter what height you are, what floor you're on, and so this urban food movement needs to really take hold, and I think we're very close to seeing that happen.
Yep. Do you, are you, Julia Whitty?
I'm fascinated to hear this, and I'm making notes. Because, I'm really interested in that, and I'm very glad to have Mark Cohen and tell us about that. I do think these are the kind of solutions that we are capable of. We have, you know, we have this brain that we've been all prideful about for quite a while now, and we need to actually live up to it. We need to live up to our name, Homo sapiens, the prudent or wise one. And we have those abilities. So I am looking forward to the innovation that is really coming out. And this is what I mean about critical mass. I think people are becoming concerned enough, and they're turning their personal energies towards finding solutions and or implementing the existing solutions. And this is where the change will happen, and I think it's underway.
Hmm. You know, I'm thinking of some pretty high-profile animals, I guess, in Wisconsin. The wolf, the timber wolf, was reintroduced to northern Wisconsin. And now they're talking about taking it off. I think it actually was taken off an endangered list. And there's talk about whether or not they've grown to a big enough population to start hunting them. And the same happens with grizzly bears in Yellowstone or whatever. And some people are upset when an animal that was once threatened is taken off the endangered species list. What's your take on this? Is that a success story when it's taken off the endangered species list, or are we asking for trouble by doing that?
Well, the current administration is trying actually to fundamentally change the Endangered Species Act and how it's implemented, and this is alarming. And it manifests in things like removing the timber wolf from the endangered species list. Because what we did in the initial input of the Endangered Species Act was the idea that, hey, if you once had timber wolves roaming 40% of America and you know, then you need to consider it endangered in 40% of America. And what the Bush administration has been attempting to do is say, well, what we have is these little remnant populations, these miniature, tiny, barely hanging on there populations of timber wolves, and they're doing okay. You know, there's like been 100 of those now for 20 years, so let's remove them. Well, what about the rest of the 39% that you needed? And I talk in the article about the fact that the smaller the numbers of a species, the fewer individuals within a species, the far more vulnerable it is to extinction. And scientists actually have sort of pegs at which you can begin to see. And again, you're removing the immune system. You're removing the genetic variation from a species. So any little change, a little climate change, a change in rainfall patterns, you know, in some cases when you get below 50 individuals, then the population begins to experience this massive arrhythmia. It just vacillates rapidly between big population bursts and crashes, and it's gone very quickly. The health of a species requires that it have significant, a buffer population, and to be removing these barely existing populations like timber wolves is really a very short-sighted approach, and not what the founders of the Endangered Species Act had in mind when they enacted this revolutionary legislation back in the 70s.
Next, we go to Tom in Burlington. Good morning, Tom.
It's a beautiful day here in Wisconsin. We have a lot of things growing now in May. Listen, I was down in Belize, and there's a barrier reef down there, the second largest barrier reef in the world next to Australia, and I was just absolutely astounded by the amount of life that's in that in the barrier reef. It was just unbelievable. But I talked to a man there who was a scientist, or he had something to do with ecology, and he said what's destroying the reef isn't the chemicals that they're using to put into the soil, but it's the erosion of the soil coming down from the hills. That's where we get the mahogany. And I wonder if you know something about that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Tom. That's absolutely true. And it is, I mean, when I talked about the many impacts of us on the land, one of them is pollution, but the other one is runoff from the land. The corals not only need a very low nutrient environment, they need an extreme extremely clear water environment. If there is sediment in the water, it settles onto the corals and it will kill them. So many times downstream of, let's say, poorly planted agriculture, so maybe agriculture in mountainous or hillsides that isn't terraced well, so that with each tropical rain, and there are a lot of them, you're getting a lot of soil runoff, and you can see this big plume of kind of reddish or brownish water that's washing out to the reef. And, you know, in my lifetime, I've seen reefs that I knew well are now dead because of new agriculture that came into an area and the downstream effect of the runoff of soil. So we have to, this is again when I talk about our footprint on the planet, is thinking about what is the impact. Okay, we want to put in a pineapple plantation, and maybe that's okay, but can we do it? We know how to do it in a fashion that it will not impact coral reefs. The truth is, will we make that choice and do that? That's what we need to begin considering when we think of the finite bank account of planet Earth.
Yeah. And how endangered are the coral reefs? Tom brought up two areas where I know they're still around and still stunning and beautiful, but how many are gone?
There's 25% are seriously endangered worldwide right now, and perhaps we're looking at 50%. There's some serious questions about whether coral reefs will survive the global warming that's coming, because they can only live within a very small temperature range. And on top of that stress of changing and warming temperature, you have all these other assaults. So you already have a weakened system, weakened from what we do on the land, that's affecting this fragile edge between the land and the sea. And you add, global warming on top of that, and it's kind of the death knell for reefs. Around the world right now, we've got serious reefs. Most of the Caribbean reefs are gone.
Yeah.
They've been lost, and you have basically the lettuce gardens underwater right now, and they may never recover, at least not in the manageable future.
Rob in Iola is with us. Hi, Rob.
Hi there. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I had a question. Well, I used to be a commercial diver, and I dove in the Gulf of Mexico on the oil rigs. And now I'm just a recreational diver, but recently I made a trip to Hawaii on the island of Oahu, and they had a sunken ship there that was put there by the Navy. It was about an 80 to 100 foot ship, and it was in approximately 90 feet of water. It was set there as an artificial reef.
Yeah, we're almost out of time. Rob, are those artificial reefs helpful, Julia Witte?
Well, they certainly can be. They can seed new life, and they can make some great dives. But if the conditions for life aren't good, if your water is warming up and you're having stuff running off from the land, then your artificial reef isn't going to grow and seed itself. So it can sometimes help. It's certainly worth trying, but it's not the only solution that we have to go for.
Yeah, and very briefly, do tsunamis or hurricanes destroy coral reefs? Rob also wanted to know.
Yes, they do. But one of the important things to know is that where there are living coral reefs, and we saw this in the Indian Ocean tsunami, where there's healthy living coral reefs, the land was buffered. Mm. So they are important to us, even if we don't go anywhere near them underwater. They are very important that we maintain them.
Well, we're out of time. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you, Julie.
Julia Witte, author of The Fragile Edge and also author of the cover story in the current issue of Mother Jones entitled Gone. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing the hour and to Leo Duran for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.